Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
In 1814, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, and we caught the bloody British in a town in New Orleans. We fired our guns
like the original Beverly Hillbillies. Some of the most interesting facets of Northwest history are easy to forget about, either because they just aren't around anymore, or in some cases because their historic plaques keep washing away. And that's why we have our resident historian, Felix Bunnell, to tell us about a forgotten fort that once stood along the Snoqualmie River.
Yeah, I stumbled across a reference of a place called Fort Tilton in an old book not long ago, and my ears perked right up. Who doesn't love old forgotten forts? It was about 163 years ago this week, back in 1856, when Washington Territorial Governor Isaac Stevens, who we often talk about here on Wednesday mornings, instructed the militia to build a series of defensive structures out in the Snoqualmie Valley. This was during what was called the Treaty War of 1855 and 1856, when problematic treaty processes, to say the least, and the arrival of more and more settlers had led to escalating violence. Christy Lakes, the assistant director of the Snoqualmie Valley Historical Museum, she told me that Fort Tilton was built in February and March of 1856, about a mile or so below Snoqualmie Falls on the north bank of the river. It's along what's now called Hatchery Road near the state fish hatchery at Tocal Creek. You'll see signs for that if you ever drive from Falls City up to Snoqualmie Falls. I asked Christy Lake what Fort Tilton looked like.
The way I would describe it is it looks like a log house with no windows. It was a very simple log structure, about 14 feet by about 20 feet, with a reinforced door. It had a dirt floor. Its main purpose was to store supplies. The men would have been camped in tents around the area.
So this wasn't a huge fort built to house hundreds or even dozens of men. It was like a reinforced storage structure that could double as a blockhouse in the event of an attack. As Christy said, as many as 200 men would have been camped in tents around the fort. Christy Lake says Snoqualmie Pass was a strategic route over the mountains, even then. And during the Treaty War, the military thought natives from eastern Washington might cross over to attack settlers on the west side.
Because the people in Seattle feared that the Yakima were going to come over the pass and invade Seattle, they felt that if they put some outposts along the Snoqualmie River, that they would have enough advanced warning to be able to stop that.
So the story is fairly complicated, with all kinds of social, cultural, military, and economic factors in play. But the leader of the Snoqualmies then was a man named Pat Canem. He tried to organize an attack on settlers back in the 1840s, but was unable to do so. So by the time of the Treaty War, Pat Canem had managed to consolidate native groups in the Snoqualmie Valley and had considerable power. And he was generally considered to be non-hostile toward American settlers. The Snoqualmies were actually viewed as allies against other natives angered by the treaty process. But Christy Lake says it was, of course, more complicated than that, and the complications were also part of the reason for building Fort Tilton and an additional four more forts in the Snoqualmie Valley in 1856.
Some of the settlers really saw Pat Canem as a friend to the U.S. government, whereas others were very suspicious of him. So depending on which historic documents you read, you get very different versions. And so another reason for having the forts in the Snoqualmie Valley was locating U.S. troops with weapons at his strategic villages to make sure that he didn't actually join the uprising, because there was a fear that if the Snoqualmie tribe joined an uprising, that the U.S. government wouldn't be able to win.
So the Treaty War was pretty much over by the end of 1856, and the forts were abandoned. Fort Tilton was standing as late as the 1880s, according to some eyewitness accounts from about 100 years ago. Now, the Washington State Historical Society and the Daughters of the Pioneers installed a bronze and stone marker at the site of Fort Tilton in the late 1920s, but it was washed away by a flood not long after. Then a wood marker installed in the 70s was also washed away, as was an interpretive panel installed in the early 2000s. So the actual site of the fort, it's private property, it's a residence, but the roadside where the markers used to be is publicly accessible. There are no plans to do any archaeological exploration there, and Christy says she knows of no effort to install another marker, because it would probably just wash away. I did ask Christy Lake one more question about Fort Tilton, and that was, Just who was that windowless and floorless log house named for?
It was named for James Tilton, who was the surveyor general for the state of Washington. And he was also the officer that was above the person that was stationed at the fort that named it. So he was naming it after his superior officer.
So that guy's kind of a suck up then, is what you're saying.
Oh, totally.
And I don't recognize the name. There's nothing else named for him around here?
No, and he has his own interesting backstory, which we have links to at My Northwest. He actually owned a slave. And I mean, Tilton's a very complicated guy that completely separate from this fort being named after him. But I asked Christy if that bronze marker might still be there in the riverbed. She thinks it could just be buried below the silt.
Where is it again?
Well, if you drive from Falls City up to Snoqualmie Falls on the back road,
right,
about a mile out of Falls City, you'll see a sign for Fish Hatchery Road. And this is on Fish Hatchery Road right along the bank of the river, and where these signs have been placed now three times and been washed away.
Felix Bunnell joins us every Wednesday with a piece of Northwest history, and all his features are at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thank you.
We were told going into this State of the Union address that this year's speech would emphasize the things that both parties in Congress could get behind. And after the speech, we talked with Congressman Derek Kilmer, Democrat from the state's 6th District, to see if he thinks there is any common ground with the president.
Well, I think there are some issues that you could see Democrats and Republicans come together on. For example, you've heard the president talk for years about our crumbling infrastructure. I've yet to see a Democratic road or a Republican bridge. We know we have transit systems in need of repair. We have a power grid waiting to enter the 21st century.
What's in it for Washington State here? Are there large projects that have been delayed for lack of federal funds? And how optimistic are you that there might be some progress there?
Well, the American Society of Civil Engineers grades out American infrastructure at a B+. I think there are parts of our state where the speed limit signs are only there for nostalgic purposes. Certainly in our state capital, you saw legislators step up in a bipartisan way on transportation infrastructure. I'd like to believe that Congress could do that, too, in concert with this administration.
But when? This year? I mean, when? What people want to know when you're going to see some kind of change. So are we talking about something that gets passed this year? Or?
I certainly have a sense of urgency about seeing something happen on infrastructure, in part because we've got clear areas of need. Frankly, not just with regard to transportation infrastructure, but listen, I represent a district that's in the bottom 20% of the country when it comes to access to high-speed internet. And so whether we're talking about our electrical grid or we're talking about access to internet or we're talking about roads and bridges, I think that's something you could see certainly pass out of the House, hopefully find some common ground in the Senate, and ideally get signed by this president.
Hey, we are 9 days away from a government shutdown if that wall doesn't get funding, and I saw nothing that indicates the president is backing away from that. He's talking about slats instead of concrete, but he still says it's essential, and he took some pains to make that point. Do you think that there is going to be a deal before that deadline?
I think you'll see Democrats and Republicans agree on an appropriations bill. You know, the proposal that I've supported is a bipartisan bill called the USA Act, which says let's do a mile-by-mile assessment of our southern border and determine what's the most cost-effective and smartest way to address that.
And if he declares a border emergency instead and has the Army Corps of Engineers build the wall?
Well, I think he'll certainly, if he does that, will be challenged in the court process. You know, listen, I met last week with the Army Corps, and there are significant needs in our region when it comes to the Army Corps. I've been out in Westport and out in Ocean Shores where there's real concerns around coastal resiliency. You've seen the Puget Sound ecosystem restoration investments. Those are investments that go through the Army Corps of Engineers. You've seen projects related to the competitiveness of our ports, dredging projects and the like. And so that's not a zero-sum game. If the president chooses to raid money out of the funds of the Army Corps of Engineers, there are communities in our region that will suffer for that.
Of course, we saw the pictures of the women who were dressed in white, the color of suffragettes, to call attention to women's issues. But I noticed that when the president talked about the number of jobs created for women, there was a looking back and forth, you know, among the Democrats, deciding whether to stand or not. So who decides when you stand? At one point, I saw Nancy Pelosi, you know, raising her hands, you know, like they do in church, saying, okay, time to stand. Do you take the cue from her, or is it just sort of a consensus that develops in the moment?
It's pretty organic, honestly. There's, you know, I think every member sort of decides what issues they're motivated to stand on. I thankfully was wearing my Fitbit because it was a hell of a cardio workout. Listen, I am someone who is hopeful that we could actually see more common ground in Washington, D.C., that we could actually move forward on issues that matter to the American people. A lot of my district has not enjoyed the type of economic recovery that you've seen in Seattle. We still have communities that are struggling economically in Washington 6th Congressional District, and I will always look to try to find some common ground to move us forward on those issues. Having said that, there are going to be issues where you see Democrats stand our ground if the president moves forward with policies that we've seen over the course of the first 2 years of this administration. I think it remains to be seen. When I walked off the floor with my guest, I brought Chairman Leonard Forsman, who's the chairman of the Suquamish tribe, and it was part of the conversation we had. He said, "So it seems like there might be some stuff to work on. Does that give you hope?" And I'm a genetically hopeful person. I couldn't be in this job if I didn't think that there was some opportunity to make positive impact for the folks I represent.
Congressman Derek Kilmer, who represents the 6th District, which is the Tacoma area, Kitsap Peninsula, and the Olympic Peninsula. There was a tense state Senate committee hearing yesterday afternoon. Frustrated lawmakers were trying to do something about the city of Seattle's homeless policies, and in particular, some of the encampments that we see every single day driving into work and driving home from work. And here's KIRIA's Hannah Scott to tell us how that went down.
So this was a work session in the Senate Transportation Committee with WashDOT and the city of Seattle about what can be done to deal with all of those dangerous homeless encampments set up all across the highways. It's a big problem here in Seattle, but also across the state. Senator Steve Hobbs made clear from the start he has concerns.
So a lot of this has to do with safety. The reason why this has kind of motivated me is because, you know, I do travel that quite a bit, and I've seen a lot of tents and debris. One time I saw a tent nearly blow into the highway. Luckily, some folks grabbed onto the tent. I've seen a shopping cart almost go into the highway. We've already had one death of a person rolling into the highway. There might be more. The other issue is having toured the state and talking to the rank and file DOT maintenance workers who are out there, the hardworking men and women. It's unsafe for them.
And some of them spoke at this hearing yesterday. They talked about gallons and gallons of syringes being out in these places where they go to do these cleanups, feces, other things that are things that they weren't trained to do. That's not what their job was supposed to be. Hobbs also had some big questions about the 72-hour notice that campers get before they have to be moved out.
I mean, 72 hours in that area where I see someone where a tent being blown, that's dangerous. And 72 hours on an incline right there, that's dangerous. I've seen, and we've all seen it, where you have tents on sides of hills where it's very dangerous. And I know, again, lack of resources. We're going to provide you the resources because I know it's tough. But I feel like the 72-hour rule, I think maybe that's going a little too far.
He asked that, and that 72-hour rule is part of an agreement between WashDOT and the city of Seattle.
He's saying 72 is too long to wait.
He said we need to revisit that. It's a problem. Jason Johnson, though, with Seattle Human Services, says they use those 72 hours wisely.
Yeah, I think it's important to understand what happens during that 72-hour period. That's a period where we can have outreach workers go in and start engaging with folks. Typically, once that 72-hour posting was there, and people knew crews were coming, work was going to be done. They were not able to stay in that location. There was both the motivation to leave as well as the resource provided and somewhere for them to go. So there's active work that happens during that 72-hour.
Senator Curtis King frustrated.
It's just inconceivable to me that we allow people to live the way these people are living. It's inconceivable to me that we allow people to live where they are living. It's also, I mean, if you look at this, you look at the contamination that's done here. If a business did this, if a business had sewage running out of their property, guess what would happen to them? But we just accept it because we say, oh, they're homeless.
And he said it's not that he doesn't understand the homeless situation.
Now, I have a lot of empathy for these people. I'm not hard-hearted. But my point is, we've talked about this for how many years in these encampments underneath, abutments and roads. And we're not getting any further. We're getting further behind. And we have laws about involuntary treatment. We need to go in there and do what needs to be done.
Now, the money, of course, is the problem here. Mm-hmm. Clearly, these encampments, we know now why people are in the encampments. It's not that there isn't room for them in the shelters. They don't like the rules of the shelters. Mm-hmm. A lot of the rules say no drugs. And that's why you see all these needles here. So in addition to offering people shelter, apparently you have to require, involuntary treatment, which means money. Is the state, is he prepared to pry loose more money for that?
This is the Transportation Committee. So this will specifically deal with the WashDOT and Seattle, City of Seattle, clearing these areas that we're talking about, these encampments on the inclines on the side of the freeways. He is absolutely going to propose a bill, and he's asking that everyone support it, for 4 full-time WashDOT workers to help clear these encampments that are on the side of the freeways. He wants money for State Patrol to be there as security.
And to go back again, because as I recall, this has been a year since I talked to them, but in San Francisco, when they cleared out their jungle, they then had daily patrols, which went back, and the minute they saw somebody set up, they said, no, you can't camp here.
Yeah, and I would expect that this is going to be part of a bill that he proposes. It was very, very clear that they have a lot of frustration. They do not like the 72-hour rule. As Senator Fortunato said, we need to put in these areas where it's dangerous, we need to put up there a sign that says, if you choose to squat here, was the word he used, you will get no notice. We will come and we will remove you. Not give you the offer of shelter, not give you the offer of this. We will remove you. You can go to the shelter, but you know we're not going to give you those 3 days.
Yeah, one of the things that we see a lot, all of those places are marked as if you come in here, you're trespassing.
Right.
And of course, if anybody trespasses who's a regular person, you get arrested. You don't if you're a homeless person. Yep. But the thing that's no one even mentions in all of this, Senator Hobbs mentioned the one death. The thing I hear from our drivers all the time, especially those that drive odd hours, not necessarily during the commute, the primary commutes, is the amount of actual people riding bikes.
Yes.
And running back and forth across full lanes of freeway, especially under the clover leaf for I-90 and I-5 through the collector distributor lanes, because you've got a series of little tent cities that are divided and people are going back and forth between them on
them.
The freeways.
On the southbound Rainier entrance ramp, that tunnel there where you have to go around a curve, the people use that as an access path.
Exactly. And I'm surprised. I mean, there are people who ride their bikes diagonally and perpendicularly across I-90 to get between there and Dearborn. And it's incredibly dangerous. I'm surprised we don't have more injuries, fatalities, just because of the way the people migrate back and forth using the freeway system as walkers or bikers.
And it's
dangerous.
As much about the safety of those people camping there as it is for if the tent were to fly into the freeway.
Or if a person hit a person on a bike.
Very dangerous.
Okay, so this was a work session. What's the next step?
The next step is he's proposing a bill that will come with that four full-time employees with WashDOT to get out there.
Hire 4 more people and that's going to fix it?
That's a separate crew. That's more than what they have now. Right now, it is a partnership with WashDOT and the City of Seattle, and I expect there will be more than that. He needed to cure all this, see what the issues are. He promised to have, though, a bill for the 4 full-time employees, money to get the State Patrol so they can provide security for the WashDOT maintenance crews to get out there. And the idea is to have those 4 full-time workers there so that the maintenance workers who are having to do this now can actually do their regular jobs that they're supposed to do. So we'll see how it comes to fruition, but they are definitely passionate about this, and I expect we'll see something soon.
Cairo's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness now. Plenty of kids around here home from school because of the snow and ice. Many on their third day of canceled classes because of the snow. Maybe struggling to find things to do to stay busy. In Grand Rapids, Michigan, where the polar vortex has kept kids home, 7-year-old Conrad Veldhaus found a very useful way to use his free time. It started with a question from Conrad and his 2 brothers to their mom, putting them to bed, wondering what the homeless do in extreme cold.
Mom said, what do you think we could do for them? And I said, pray for them. And Mom said, what else can we do?
Conrad said he'd use his own money to buy them what they'd need to survive the cold. It was that easy. He came up with the answer. He gave up his $20 savings from his birthday and chores, began asking teachers for donations and co-workers of his parents' work. In the span of a couple of days, Conrad had raised $1,800, teamed up with a nonprofit, too.
We raised enough money to get a lot of boots, mittens, hats, and gloves to all the people that need them.
They dropped off the supplies at the nonprofit. Volunteers lined up to move box after box out of the minivan.
To have a young person like that see the need and respond is a great lesson to all of us, that when we see something, we need to do something, and that's how change occurs.
Of course, around here, the advice is always to help out the nonprofits, or even it's not a bad idea just to keep some spare gloves or socks in your car to hand out as needed.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, Danny O'Neill from 710 ESPN. We've been talking about the UW men's basketball team, which has now won 11 games in a row. And so I assume that the national media are flocking to the Heck Ed Pavilion, or whatever we call it these days, to cover the story.
You're unfamiliar with the national media then. They can't see past the Mississippi.
It's crazy.
Well, maybe they can see to Kansas. Now, the Pac-12 is a backwater this year. It is a backwater.
And for what reason? What's the reason?
Well, because their teams got drubbed in the NCAA tournament a year ago. Oh, and the conference certainly is down. It doesn't help that a couple of the programs have been implicated in an ongoing FBI investigation.
Another FBI investigation?
No, this is the same one. Still just going. They're just now getting around to putting most of the people in the clink.
I see.
Yeah.
So, in other words, we know no matter how many games the Huskies win, they're not going to be respected.
Well, probably not. They didn't have a big non-conference win over a ranked opponent. Virginia Tech beat them. They were competitive with Gonzaga, which is now ranked number 4. It ended up losing by 2 in
that
game.
Does Gonzaga get respect? The national media flocked?
Yeah, it took some while, though.
Yeah.
It took a while.
But I mean, they can't pronounce the name still.
No, they still give them
14 years
Gonzaga
in the NCAA championships, yeah, and they still can't get it right?
I like to think it's like Al Pacino's character in Son of a Woman, where he gets excoriated for mispronouncing one of his relative's wives, and he goes, I guess it's just not important for me to get it right.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, well. So let's talk about the Super Bowl hangover, which is yet another sports concept that I have no idea what it means. So what is it?
Well, it used to be that when you lost the Super Bowl, it was really hard to make it back to the playoffs. In fact, I remember in 2006 being given what I termed as a steaming bag of dog poo assignment, which was, can you write about the Super Bowl hangover? And I was like, well, what? And it was that the last five teams that had lost the Super Bowl had not made it back to the playoffs the following season, in which the teams that won the Super Bowl had tended to be more successful. Well, it turned out that that was a little five-year blip in what is a really non-existent trend. The one thing that, if you look at the teams that win and lose the Super Bowl, there shouldn't be that great a difference in their projections the next season, right? They both played the same number of games, so it's not like one is getting more recovery time than the other. They've got the same obstacles of dealing with, they were in the spotlight, other teams are going to come poaching their players. Yet, so I looked at the last 24 Super Bowls, and how did those teams do the following season? It turns out the team that won the Super Bowl won an average of about a game more. They made the playoffs at about the same rate. 16 of the 24 teams that won the Super Bowl made the playoffs the following season. 15 of the 24 that lost it made it the following season. The most significant difference, though, is that there were 8 times a team that lost the Super Bowl went on and had a losing record the following season. That only happened twice for teams that won the Super Bowl, and one of those was after John Elway retired, which would mean that if you lose the Super Bowl, you're 4 times more likely to go in the toilet, Dave.
Interesting. What is that? Is it a loss of confidence?
It's a great question.
Too many changes because we lost the Super Bowl, so they shuffle the deck and it's too much?
I don't know. And it's because it shouldn't be that big a difference.
Yeah.
Both teams make it to the final rung of the ladder.
They were both the top teams.
And you could make a logical argument that the team that won the Super Bowl wouldn't be as hungry the next year, would be more complacent. The team that lost the Super Bowl, but that hasn't turned out to be the case. Losing the Super Bowl certainly is not a sign that, hey, you're going to get over the hump next year. I say this is a long way of saying the Rams are in trouble. I went to extreme lengths to construct a scenario in which the Rams might have problems this year.
I
did it for you, Dave.
I'm
a giver.
I have a feeling that this is one of those experiments where there are way too many unknowns in the equation for the statistics to have any meaning whatsoever. So many things can change.
Yeah, that's true. You can. But 24 years is a pretty broad span. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a pretty, and that's a time when the salary cap was in place, the rules were. I think it's a pretty broad swath to look at, and I think there is something to that, that some teams that lose the Super Bowl aren't ever the same again.
I'd be curious to know what, if there was a relationship between losing the Super Bowl and fan-supported, you know, season ticket sales, for example.
I would guess that it's not, and we've entered a time where a lot of teams pretty habitually sell out. Mm-hmm. But if you make it to the Super Bowl, you've engendered a ton
That's
of enthusiasm.
Because losing the Super Bowl means you made it there at least.
Correct.
Right? So you had a really exciting playoff season.
You had a great season.
Which...
You won at least two playoff games to get there. People are going to be jazzed.
Yeah.
I mean, there wasn't a lack of fan support for the Seahawks in 2006 after they lost the Super Bowl.
Oh.
Took them a good 4 years to frigate
out. One of the genius things about the NFL is that they've figured out a way to keep just about everybody interested pretty deep into the season.
That's yeah. Socialists.
I have my own theories on that.
Oh, really? What are your theories,
Colleen?
Well,
if you look at Century, I just don't think there's enough seats in CenturyLink to fit the fans, so you've got a supply and demand thing. So if you can't get to the game, it's too expensive, it becomes coveted, people want it, it becomes sort of feverish,
manufactured
right?
scarcity.
Yeah, manufactured scarcity. And we also have a good team, but
yeah.
Look at the sustained popularity of the Seahawks and the demand for tickets to CenturyLink Field, even after a few seasons where they didn't make it.
Yeah, there could be something to that, but they also, when they first opened the stadium in 2002, they weren't selling out, and it was a huge problem because one of the things that you get when that happens is opposing fans whose teams are selling out mm-hmm. then see that as an opportunity to get tickets
yeah.
and it creates a more difficult environment because the home fans feel like they're under siege, that they've got to defend their turf.
Yeah.
It actually changes the dynamics of it. There's something to that seating capacity. Seating capacity is certainly
zero proof that this is actually a thing. I'm just thinking.
I want more of Colleen's theories on sports. They're fun to test.
That's the great thing about sports. You can be completely wrong, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look at me. 20
you,
years strong in this business. I'm an idiot.
Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Let's go live to the White House and correspondent Stephen Portnoy to find out what happens on the day after the State of the Union. Is everyone exhausted by the experience, or are they going to go forward and pass all these bipartisan things the president was talking about, like highway money, for example?
Right. Look, I think we're settling back into reality after what was a pretty good night for the president. Our CBS News poll indicates that most people who watched the speech felt that the president did a good job. Of course, most people who watched the speech, according to our survey, were more inclined to be supporters of the president than detractors or opponents of the president. And only 24% in our survey said that they disapproved of what they saw last night. Now, many people who are not inclined to like the president may not have watched. Those who were in the hall, the Democrats, clearly didn't like a lot of what they heard. You saw Democrats looking visibly uncomfortable as the president hailed a booming economy, except for when he spoke of the newly created jobs, mainly for women, and the Democratic women of the House leapt to their feet, clad in white, and raised the roof and hooted and hollered because
yes.
They were pointing to themselves as examples of women who are in newly created jobs as a result of the Democratic takeover of the House.
So they were actually, in sort of a backhanded way, thanking Trump for helping them win.
Yeah, and the president kind of got a little bit of a chuckle out of that. He said, you weren't supposed to stand, or you weren't supposed to do that, because he believed that Democrats would sit on their hands for the entire speech.
Well, but they didn't, though. Actually, both sides found a reason to chant USA, USA at various points.
Right. Yes, exactly. Well, there were a number of moments, beautiful moments of bipartisanship, especially as the president pointed to the guests in the First Lady's box. You had two Holocaust survivors, one of whom had his 81st birthday, and the crowd spontaneously burst into the singing of Happy Birthday. You had a 10-year-old cancer survivor who, before she was stricken by cancer, raised money to help others. You had the hero police officer from the Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh. A number of examples of things that the president has done or wanted to point to or highlight that he felt could engender bipartisan approval, and they certainly did, including his commutation of the sentence of Alice Johnson, the woman who was convicted under drug laws, and the first man to be released from prison as a result of the campaign finance reform the president signed late last year. But there were sharply partisan lines in the president's speech. He talked about the fact that if there's going to be, as he put it, peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way, he said. He spoke of the tremendous onslaught that he sees coming from the caravans and the threat to the safety that they pose. He says he will never abolish the heroes of ICE. He will get the wall built. Mm-hmm. He talked about Democrats wanting to rip babies from their mother's wombs and execute babies after birth.
Yeah. Is there going to be a big abortion debate this year?
Well, I don't think that you're going to see this Democrat-controlled House pass any kind of abortion laws. Yeah. But, you know, obviously this is an issue that's percolating in the states, and at a certain point may wind up rising to the level of the Supreme Court. And then it's going to be all hands on deck here in Washington.
Yeah.
Another bit of news the president made was when he announced that he'll be having his next summit with Kim Jong-un 3 weeks from today. As soon as we're done here, Dave, this reporter's going to get right onto the travel website to try to book his flight.
Oh, good for you. Well, that should be pretty exciting. The other thing I want to ask you about was the whole fact-checking business. I was following the New York Times fact-check, and they actually came up with a substantial number of points that they decided were true, like we are making a pile of money through those tariffs on Chinese goods, et cetera, et cetera. But I did not hear anything about another big issue, and that being the shutdown. And or the declaration of some kind of national emergency, which I was told by our own congressman here that if they take money out of the Army Corps of Engineers to build a wall, that would come out of projects that our state and I presume other states were expecting money for.
Yeah, and that's going to be a pressure point for the president when it comes to that decision on whether he's going to declare a national emergency, because the only thing he can do is take money from projects that have already been dedicated by Congress to other purposes. And you're going to have Republicans and Democrats who will cry foul on that. And there's also the possibility, if not likelihood, that if the president moves forward, the Democratic-controlled House will pass a resolution of disapproval to undo the emergency declaration that would ultimately set up a vote in the Senate that can't be easily put off without the Republicans going on the record. Yesterday, Lindsey Graham, the influential ally of the president, said that Republicans really need to stick together behind the president on this. But it only takes a small handful of Republicans to join with the minority Democrats to send the president that resolution of disapproval. Now, ultimately, he can veto that. I don't think you necessarily have two-thirds in both houses to override a veto, but it would definitely put Republicans on the record, and they're hoping to avoid having to take a vote on it.
CBS White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy, he'll be on his way to Vietnam. Thank you, Stephen.
You bet.
You know him from The Daily Show. You know him from NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You know him from CBS This Morning. And now you know him because of his new podcast called Mobituaries. It is CBS's Mo Rocca. And Mo, tell us about what is the mission of Mobituaries?
Well, look, I'll just give it to you straight. Most of my favorite most of my favorite people are dead. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to do a show about those people. And with Mobituaries, I'm giving a proper send-off to people that didn't always get the send-off they deserved or any send-off at all.
How do you decide what untold story of a dead person is worthy of a Mobituary?
Well, in the case of this week's episode, which drops tomorrow, it's about the unforgettable Audrey Hepburn. And there are a couple of different reasons I wanted to do Audrey Hepburn, one of which is that the timing of her death wasn't so great. She died pretty much 20 years too early. She died way too young. But she also died the day that Bill Clinton was inaugurated, his first inaugural. So she was pushed right off the front page. We all love Audrey Hepburn, but I wanted to kind of dig a little deeper and find out why we love her, why this woman who has been gone for more than a quarter of a century still trends on social media, why her image is still kind of everywhere. I actually had a personal experience with her, too. When I was in my early 20s, I was working at Macy's in Herald Square in New York at the fragrance counter. I was not a spritzer. The spritzers are the male models that are in front of the counter that right. terrorize people yeah. with their fragrance. I was behind the counter. Okay. So the male model would lure the customer in, and I'd sell the customer on the different merchandise. But she walked by my counter one day in 1992, and I'm telling you, it just everything stopped, and this was the world's largest department store. The main floor fell silent.
Oh,
it's the kind of thing that even if we'd had cell phones back then, you wouldn't have thought to kind of shove your hand in front of her face for a selfie. And so I kind of, with the team here, my team of amazing producers, wanted to kind of dig in and find out, what is it? Where did that quality come from in Audrey Hepburn that still captivates us?
Yeah, between Audrey Hepburn, Angela Cartwright, and Denise from the Mickey Mouse Show. Yeah, those are my three TV crushes.
Is that right?
Yeah. So tell me, well, I listened to your Mo bit on Vaughn Meter, the guy who made his living for a while impersonating Jack Kennedy, and kind of the tragic thing that happened to him. And it was just beautifully produced, and so much that I hadn't heard. And his was an interesting story because he wasn't, he was more of a mimic than a comedian. And he got so tired of doing Jack Kennedy, it sort of affected his life.
Right. And that, by the way, was a surprise. And for listeners who don't know, Vaughn Meter was wildly famous at one point. He had this uncanny impression he did of President Kennedy. And his comedy album that he headlined, The First Family, which was kind of a gentle spoof of the First Family, of the young Kennedy family, not hard-edged satire, affectionate. It was a huge hit. It was one of the first comedy albums, period. And people of a certain age all know this album and grew up with it. And when November 22nd, 1963 came, the assassination of President Kennedy, Vaughn Meter essentially disappeared, except that he lived for another 40 years. And I had heard of him, but it was one of our producers, Megan Marcus, who had this idea to go into the CBS News archives, and they are kind of a legendary archives, and she found a tape of Vaughn Meter, a 90-minute long tape, shortly before he died, talking about what it was like kind of to be dead when you were alive.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a man who for 40 years, and I think it's sort of symbolic, 40 years in the desert, right? Kind of was a reminder to people of a shocking incident, of a man that was pretty loved. And he sort of told his whole story in this unaired interview. And so we mined from there for this podcast to kind of tell the story of not just this man, this person who experienced a terrifying, precipitous fall, you know, after that day, but also of an era when comedy was different and was gentler. You know, when he would imitate Kennedy, it was seen as very racy, very edgy. And, you know, when you listen to it now, it's a great impression, but it's not, it's hardly controversial.
Well, who's your audience for this podcast? I think that podcast's still new for many people. Those who listen to podcasts, they're all in. They have their favorites. You know, we put our show, Seattle's Morning News, into a 30-second podcast, but still to get people to listen.
30-minute podcast.
What did I say, 30-second?
30 minutes.
Woo! That would be a quick podcast. But, you know, it's still tough to get people to subscribe, to listen, and that's what keeps your stories going, Mo. So who's out there? Who's your audience for the untold stories of dead people?
Right. Well, and boy, there is such a great supply of dead people. You know, listen, first of all, the word subscribe, that's the dirty word. It turns people off. Mm-hmm. It turns me off because you think, ugh, this is something I have to sign up for. It's something I have to pay for. No, it's free. We did a segment on CBS Sunday Morning for our audience to explain that this is extremely easy, that, you know, you just go onto iTunes, you write in Mobituaries, or you just go to mobituaries.com. It's obituaries with an M on the front, and you just listen, and it's free, and it's hopefully you'll enjoy the experience. But as for who the audience is, you know, I learned early in my career, rather than thinking who do I want to attract with this, who do I want to play to, I work the opposite way. I just do things. And I'm lucky enough to do this. Mm-hmm. I do things that are interesting to me. And if I'm genuinely interested and it's well done, it will be infectious. It will attract people of all ages. I really do think that way. So I'm very allergic to sort of going, oh, we should do this person because it will get this demographic or the young people like this. It doesn't work this way. I used to tour a lot of college campuses, and stay with me here. I had a slideshow I still do. Of all the different presidential grave sites I've been to, I've been in, and I particularly like sort of the presidents you can't remember were actually president. The guys between Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt, usually from Ohio with a lot of facial hair. People right. like, you know, like James Garfield and Chester Alan Arthur. Right. And you know, and these were college students coming in. And if you had asked them before, are you going to be interested in a slideshow of obscure presidents? I'm sure they would not have walked into the room, but I was excited enough about it that it got other people excited. Yeah. So, I mean, we're casting a wide net with this. And, you know, and I should also point out that mobituaries are remembrances of not just people. So we have a mobituary coming up for Neanderthals, because when they died out 40,000 years ago, as far as we know, there was no obituary. Maybe there was like a Flintstone-like newspaper back then that kind of put them on the front page.
Well, their genes live on the rest of us.
So that is, and in fact, you are correct. Did you know how Neanderthal you are?
No, I don't want to know. Some people around here would have an opinion on that, I'm sure. Well, it's a great show. Thanks for being on. And little known, Mo Rocca's superpower is knowing the capitals of every nation in the world. Although you've been now that there's Alexa, we really don't need that anymore. But anyway, it's good.
I know. I feel exactly. Gosh, maybe we should do a mobituary for this unusable talent,
super talent
that I have. But I hope you all. I hope you all do listen to Audrey Hepburn. And next week we've got Sammy Davis Jr. coming up on Mobituaries.
Mo Rocca from CBS This Morning. Mo, thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave and Colleen.